Introducing Bluehost Cloud, ultra-fast WordPress hosting with 100% uptime. Want a website with unmatched power, speed, and control? Of course you do. And now you can have all three with Bluehost Cloud, the new web hosting plan from Bluehost. With 100% uptime and incredibly speedy load times, your WordPress websites will be dependable and lightning fast on a global scale. Plus, your sites can handle even the biggest traffic spikes without going down or lagging. And with Bluehost Cloud, you get 24/7 WordPress priority support, meaning you're connected to WordPress experts anytime you need them. Not to mention, you automatically get daily backups and world-class security. So, what are you waiting for? Get Bluehost Cloud today by visiting Bluehost.com. That's Bluehost.com.
Greetings and salutations, Scholar Warriors, and welcome to episode 154 of the Dangerous History Podcast. In this episode, I'm talking to David Ramsey Steele, who is a libertarian speaker and writer, and is the author of a number of books, including From Marx to Mises, and Atheism Explained, 3-Minute Therapy, and Therapy Breakthrough. Dr. Steele is editorial director of Open Court Publishing Company, and he is the author of the book, relatively recently published, that is the subject of our conversation today, which is Orwell, Your Orwell, A Worldview on the Slab. This book is not a biography of George Orwell. What it is a dissection of Orwell's beliefs and ideologies and how those, in some cases, changed over time, and also a debunking of the ways that George Orwell is commonly perceived and depicted in a lot of previous work done on him. But before I get into my conversation with David Ramsey Steele, I have some housekeeping to take care of. First off, I just want to urge everybody to please, if you are doing any holiday shopping for anything on Amazon, please consider going through any of my Amazon affiliate links on profcj.org, dangeroushistorypodcast.com. Either will get you to the same place. And if you buy stuff from Amazon after first going through any of my Amazon links, the Dangerous History Podcast will get a small commission at no additional cost to you. Secondly, if you're looking for stock audio or visual or audiovisual material for your own productions of videos, podcasts, or whatever, please consider looking at Pond 5, which is where I've gotten a lot of the music I've used in this show, particularly the music I've used throughout the Not-So-Civil War series, music that many of you have complimented me on and asked me about. Pond 5 is a great source for royalty-free audio and visual stock material, including music, that you just do a one-time purchase and then you can use it in your own productions and not have to worry about paying additional royalties. And if you go through the Pond 5 affiliate link found on my website and then buy some stuff, I get a commission from that, again, at no additional cost to you as well. Also, I want to draw attention, as I always do, to Patreon. Please consider going to patreon.com/profcj and signing up to support the Dangerous History Podcast at $5 per month or more. And if you do that, not only do you get access to bonus episodes there that are available nowhere else, but you'll also get early and ad and announcement slash thank you sort of stuff, free versions of regular DHP podcast episodes as well. And you'll also be eligible to join our private Facebook group if you support the Dangerous History Podcast at $5 per month or more. And again, I just want to mention that I do have a goal set on Patreon right now, and that is to get up to $1,500 per month. And if I can do that, I can then step away from teaching summer school, and that will free up almost an additional 2 months of my time to devote to the DHP and other related projects I have in mind but simply haven't been able to work on due to lack of time. So please consider stepping up to support the show if you're not doing so already. And speaking of which, I do have one thank you. One individual has stepped up since the last episode that I recorded. Big thank yous go out to Raymond, who has been a longtime supporter of the show and then briefly had to step away and then is back. So Raymond, welcome back. Great to have you back. And again, I hope the rest of you listening will consider supporting the show via Patreon if you're not already doing so. Also, in regard to this episode, special thanks to DHP listener and supporter Lee for recommending this book to me and putting me in touch with Dr. Steele in order to have this conversation. Okay, on to my conversation with David Ramsey Steele about the intellectual history of George Orwell. David Ramsey Steele is my guest on the Dangerous History Podcast today, and he's the author of several books, most recently the book Orwell, Your Orwell, A Worldview on the Slab, which digs into the beliefs of Eric Blair, of course better known as George Orwell. And this book takes a contrarian view of a lot of the usual portrayal of Orwell's beliefs on many important issues, and which also places those beliefs into the historical context of the time in which Orwell lived and wrote. So it's a very interesting book. And David, thank you for talking with me today.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm glad to be here.
Orwell, Your Orwell, like I said, it's a very interesting book for anyone into this sort of intellectual history. And my own familiarity with Orwell is, it's probably a little bit more than most Americans, but it's not a huge amount more. Just by way of background, of course, I've read The Big Two, 1984 and Animal Farm, multiple times on those. And I've read a few of his shorter essays and articles. You know, I've read things like Shooting an Elephant, but I've not read any other full books of his besides those two most famous ones. And I've read, I think, a few excerpts from The Road to Wiggum Pier, but I've not read the whole thing. Although, on the other hand, when I was in graduate school, I actually did a fair amount of work on modern Britain and the British Empire, where, of course, I encountered Orwell and a lot of his contemporaries and all that. So, you know, I have probably a little bit more background in the context of the things you're talking about than a lot of Americans. But at the same time, that said, I still learned a lot of new things from this book, so I found it very interesting.
Good. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yes, yes. What got you interested in delving so deeply into George Orwell's beliefs, kind of culminating in writing this book? What really got you interested in him and his beliefs as a topic?
Well, I've been familiar with Orwell's writings very broadly, you know, his essays and reviews and so on, as well as his more famous works for a long time. A pretty full collection of his writings came out in the 1960s, and I read that for sheer pleasure, I think, at the time. One of the things that actually prompted me to start writing something about Orwell was that I kept encountering things that I thought were mistaken interpretations of his outlook. And, you know, I thought it'd be a good idea to try and correct these. And I actually wrote a review of Christopher Hitchens' book on Orwell a few years ago when that came out, which Hitchens embodies some of the misconceptions about Orwell. But also there's the general, you know, I in the 1960s, I was a socialist and became a libertarian around about 1971. And so I'm very much involved personally in the history of socialism in Britain and things like that that relate directly to Orwell. So it's familiar terrain, a lot of it to me, you know, what the Communist Party was doing and saying in Britain in the 1930s is something that I'm very familiar with.
Okay, well, let's start in kind of broad brush strokes. And how would you summarize the standard portrayal of Orwell? And then how would you, you know, summarize the standard portrayal and perception of his beliefs? And then how does your book challenge that standard portrayal?
Well, there are actually, I think, several standard portrayals which relate to just how familiar the holders of these views, interpretations are with Orwell. I think that, one of the things about Orwell is that a lot of people want to claim him. It's a phenomenon that's very conspicuous and has often been remarked on, that all kinds of people want to say that Orwell is on their side. So socialists, of course, want to say he's on their side. Neoconservatives want to say he's on their side. Libertarians sometimes want to say he's on their side. So there are these different interpretations. I would say that one of the things that that distinguishes me from other people who write about Orwell is that I think that a lot of Orwell's positions that he took ideologically, his views on capitalism, socialism, and totalitarianism, were very much off the peg views. In other words, Orwell, I think, is much less original than many people take him for. Many people see Orwell as a dissenting voice, as someone, and he liked to portray himself as a dissenting voice. He liked to portray himself as a sort of outspoken heretic. But actually, if you start tabulating Orwell's views on all kinds of political issues, you find that he's always, and I say that advisedly, always, 100% of the time, he's running with a pack. He's agreeing with a fairly substantial portion of left-wing opinion of the time. And I should say here that Orwell joined the left consciously in mid-1936. So prior to mid-1936, one would have to qualify things a bit differently. But from mid-1936 on, that is until his death in January 1950, you can find that Orwell's general views on political matters are very much standard for certain segments of the left at the time.
Yeah, so he's not at all the maverick, I guess, that he's often portrayed as then.
Right. I mean, he has a rhetorical technique of presenting himself as being this kind of dissenter, the person who can see that the emperor has no clothes, that sort of thing. But actually, that's a bit misleading, you know. And I mean, I could give chapter and verse on all kinds of things, you know, his views on this, that, and the next thing. You will always find that he's in agreement with a major segment of British left-wing opinion in the 1930s and 1940s.
Right. So would it be correct to summarize kind of your description, which I think is strongly supported and compelling, of Orwell's main political beliefs, kind of along the terms of he's clearly in favor of socialism, at least after, I guess, 1936, and he's in favor of socialism not in the way that the word is often used today to mean like maybe some sort of Keynesian mixed economy with a generous welfare state, but in the sense of outright state ownership of the means of production and control of virtually the whole economy. So
right.
he favored that, like socialism in the old school sense of the word. And yet he also was trying to believe in concepts like democracy and civil liberties, and was at least seemingly somewhat oblivious to the potential tensions and contradictions of these beliefs?
Well, I think that's basically right. Oblivious would be a bit strong. Mm-hmm. People who called themselves socialists in the 1930s generally did not mean Keynesian mixed economy or anything like that. And Orwell himself says explicitly several times that by socialism he means basically a society in which the government owns everything and everybody's a government employee, and people get roughly equal incomes paid by the state. Now he also says that socialism has to be equalitarian. There shouldn't be great disparities in wealth or power. And he also says that socialism involves democracy and civil liberties. What I do in the book is I take something that Orwell, a terminological distinction that Orwell uses a lot of the time, but not completely consistently, and I use it completely consistently, and that is that Collectivism is the term for a society where the government owns everything and everybody's a government employee with a salary paid by the state. And socialism is a particular kind of collectivism, which has equality and civil liberties. That would be Orwell's position. Now, as to how oblivious he was, I think the thing is this. Orwell became convinced that collectivism was the immediate future. That is to say, not that it was a good idea or that it was worth recommending, but that it was absolutely inevitable. We could go into the reasons he thought that, but he definitely came to that conclusion when he became a socialist mid-1936. So he thought that some form of collectivism was absolutely inevitable. This wasn't a matter of a choice at all. It was coming. And he was worried that this might automatically be a totalitarian system. And that preoccupied him. He was concerned that he hoped that socialism, that collectivism would be worthy of the name socialism, as he understood it, which means that it would retain civil liberties, freedom of association, freedom of expression, and so on. And I should say that to us today, this sounds as though he must have been obtuse. But this was the standard British left-wing view in the 1930s. I mean, what happened in Britain was that in the 1920s, the old Liberal Party was replaced by the Labour Party. One of the two parties in the two-party system switched. So the Conservative Party continued, but the opposition party became the Labour Party. And the Labour Party was explicitly a socialist party. It had a platform. It had a constitution that called for the common ownership of the means of production, distribution, and exchange. And people who supported the Labour Party called themselves socialists. So it's very different from the U.S., where the word socialism would be in bad odor in respectable company, you might say. That nothing like that in Britain. One of the two main parties was an avowedly socialist party, and the people in this Labour Party were, I mean, virtually 100% of them would say to you quite sincerely that they wanted to nationalise everything and that they would preserve civil liberties, that freedom of speech and freedom of association, freedom of assembly would continue and, in fact, would be enhanced because these freedoms would no longer be distorted by the big monopolists and the big capitalists throwing their weight about. Everything would be on a level playing field, and there'd be even more freedom than there was under capitalism. So, on that point, Orwell was in line with half the population of Britain, you might say, at the time, or at least politically aware. Population, but he did begin to worry that that this might be impossible and that collectivism might mean totalitarianism. That's something that explicitly he addressed, and so there's something slightly distinctive about his view there. Now he wasn't the only person to do that, but he wasn't unique. But certainly the great majority of socialists in Britain in the 1930s would have said, oh, yeah, well, why should we get rid of civil liberties just because the government owns everything? No, that doesn't follow at all. Whereas Orwell began to have his doubts.
Yeah, and I guess a book like 1984 would be probably a pretty clear expression of those misgivings.
Right. No, the tragedy is that Orwell hated totalitarianism. He understood it very, very fully, I think, partly because of other books that came out, like Darkness at Noon by Arthur Koestler, which showed an understanding of totalitarianism. He was concerned that collectivism was absolutely inevitable. He didn't think there was any choice. Didn't think that capitalism had a hope of surviving. It was going to be abolished and it was going to be replaced by government direction and control. He was afraid that this might lead to the kind of society that you see in 1984.
Why did he believe that it was just completely inevitable that capitalism wouldn't work anymore, wouldn't sustain anymore, and that collectivism of some form was inevitable?
That's an interesting question, which I do go into in my book. First of all, there was a standard left-wing theory that was generally accepted, and you can find it in Marx's Capital, Marx's book Capital, which is that, roughly speaking, is this: there's a strong tendency for big firms to beat out small firms in competition. Therefore, competition leads to its own abolition. It leads to bigger and bigger firms, not just in absolute terms, but as a proportion of the total economy. And therefore, the ultimate tendency of capitalist competition is to lead to one big monopoly owning everything. And this is one of the powerful sort of tropes of leftism at the time, is if anybody started talking about competition, they would be dismissed as hopelessly naive. Don't you know that competition destroys itself and automatically creates monopoly? So that was the standard view. And generally speaking, Orwell accepted that standard argument. But he had other arguments for why, additional arguments for why the collectivism was bound to replace capitalism. One of them was that workers had the vote in a capitalist democracy. Workers would always tend to prefer security to liberty. So measures which gave more security to the population would tend to prevail in the long run. And therefore, gradually, there would be more and more state intervention to guarantee security. And this would be another mechanism that would lead to the government controlling everything. So those are two arguments that he accepted. There's also another argument, although it's not spelled out very clearly, that Orwell believed that the age of the machine somehow dictated a victory for central direction. It's not very well spelled out. It's a bit hazy. It's clear that it was an argument that convinced him. And in one of his rare references to anarchism, he says that he's reviewing a book which says that we can have anarchy by an anarchist that says we can have anarchy and high living standards. And Orwell says, well, this is out of the question, because high living standards involve modern technology. Modern technology involves central direction. And so you can't have an anarchist society. An anarchist society can only be a poor society because it goes with technological backwardness. So that's another argument he had. So those are three arguments he held. But also, you know, it was the prevailing view, and there is a tendency for most people. Remember, Orwell died at the age of 46, and who knows what he might have thought if he'd lived to be 90. But there is a tendency for intellectuals to accept the prevailing views. You know, today, the vast majority of intellectuals think that there's a problem of global warming, although if you ask them about it, you find that they can't tell you the first law of thermodynamics. So there is a tendency for fashionable views to have a great force. And I think that, you know, that in itself, even if Orwell had offered no arguments, it wouldn't be a mystery. There wouldn't be something very puzzling about the fact that he accepted this idea that capitalism destroys itself by creating monopoly.
Right. And then once World War II was actually going on, then he also had the added argument of collectivism is necessary in order to defeat the Axis powers, right?
That's right. He thought that, you know, in the early part of the war, which to an American means before the war, because this would be the period when it was just Britain and France against Germany and before Pearl Harbor and also before the German invasion of Russia. You know, in this early period, there were a lot of striking German victories. And Orwell said, you know, at the time, well, this shows the superiority of a planned economy over capitalism, that the Third Reich, Orwell completely accepted by no later than early 1940 and maybe earlier, that the German Third Reich was rapidly moving in the direction of Bolshevism. It was becoming more and more like the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was a more extreme form, but the whole world was moving in this direction, and the Third Reich was therefore, he actually says in one place, a socialist system. And it's bound to be superior, he thought, at organizing for war than a capitalist system where there's all this competition and all this messy private property and so on. You know, I mean, Orwell didn't know much about economics.
That's what I was going to say. It doesn't seem like it's likely that he ever encountered, for example, anything from the Austrian school, anything from Hayek or Mises or the earlier Austrians.
Right. I mean, as I say in my book, he must have heard about this. There are various ways one can show he must have heard about it. I mean, one way is simply this, that one of the most influential books on the left in Britain in the 30s was The Coming Struggle for Power by John Strachey. John Strachey was someone who put the Communist Party line. The Communist Party wouldn't let him join their party. But he loyally preached their line. But he was a brilliant persuasive writer. The Coming Struggle for Power is very persuasive and shows many of the assumptions that all people right across the left would have accepted at the time, including Orwell. But it's also quite fair, and it has a section on Mises and Hayek and Robbins, these free market people, and he deals with them reasonably fairly, but explains why they can't possibly succeed because capitalism doesn't develop in that way. So from that book alone, Orwell must have known that there were people who argued in favor of laissez-faire capitalism, and who said that the future didn't lie with or didn't necessarily lie with collectivism. But he obviously was given reasons for rejecting that view without examining it closely.
Yeah, I found it very interesting that Orwell's view on, you know, socialism, collectivism actually being very innovative and productive and modernizing, that this remained constant even from back in his early years when he was not a socialist, and how that assumption that socialism would be productive and innovative and so on was even part of his reason for opposing socialism before he converted to it, that basically he had the opposite of the main reasons that people might oppose socialism today, like you or I. You know, we might oppose socialism on the sort of Austrian school grounds of what it does to the economy and those sorts of things. So he initially opposed socialism because he believed it would lead to greater technological progress and innovation and prosperity.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. So I found that very interesting.
One sort of, there are different ways of illustrating this thinking. But one way is to look at Brave New World, which a book by Aldous Huxley that came out in 1932. And Orwell's immediate reaction to that was he was very impressed by it and more or less agreed with it, or thought he agreed with it. And then after a few years, he began to say, I'm going to write a book like that. The word dystopian hadn't come into use yet, so he didn't call it that. But he said, I'm going to write a book of that sort, but it's going to have completely different conclusions. Now, if you look at Brave New World, although people don't often use the word in connection with it, what it depicts is a socialist system. Everything's owned by the government, and one of the striking things about it is that it's in many ways very attractive. It's everybody has a high living standard, and everybody's wants are very well catered for. You know, the shocking things about Brave New World are things like controlling genetic engineering of humans and conditioning people by playing messages to them in their sleep and all that sort of thing. But there is it's clear that Aldous Huxley, when he wrote that, it never crossed his mind that maybe, you know, a socialist system wouldn't be able to deliver the goods, just wouldn't be able to provide this kind of affluence. You know, that never crossed his mind. And in fact, in many writings of the time, you find that people think of the Soviet Union as being a kind of illustration of what a socialist institutional structure would look like. But technologically, they look at the latest developments in the United States, and they assume that those two things go together. Of course, they never had gone together, and right. We know there are good reasons why they never could. But this was a common view, you know, that the Soviet Union's having difficulties because of its backwardness and encirclement by hostile imperialism and so on. All the usual excuses, but you know, when it's up and running properly, then it will be delivering the most advanced kind of technology, and that's what you see in the most advanced parts of the United States. So Orwell completely shared this view.
Yeah, which I guess could be traced back to maybe a generation earlier, people like H.G. Wells and the Fabians.
Right.
How would you characterize Orwell's relationship to the Fabians?
Well, slightly easier question is his relationship to H.G. Wells.
Yeah, I really was interested by that section of the book where you got into that.
Yeah, because he often refers to Wells. And in fact, H.G. Wells is referred to in The Road to Wigan Pier more than any other writer. So, first of all, the general picture of H.G. Wells, this part of the argument of my book is that socialism suffered a great intellectual defeat in the 1880s and 1890s. And this gave rise to a phenomenon that I call post-socialism. Lots of intellectuals in the early 20th century, they were post-socialists. That's to say, they accepted everything the socialists said about capitalism, basically. But they said that it's naive to place your faith in something like socialism. They became disenchanted with the hopes that had been placed in rationality and progress. So this intellectual defeat for socialism, instead of leading to a return to classical liberalism, instead of leading to a search for something that would be better than socialism, it led to a general disenchantment with progress and rationality. And this is the current of thought that we call fin de siècle, French for end of century. And in the English-speaking world, you see this very, very clearly in the reputation of H.G. Wells. H.G. Wells, up until about 1920, was beloved not only by a general intelligent readership, but also by intellectuals in the strict sense. But in the 1920s, the opinion of intellectuals turned against H.G. Wells. It's partly because he was writing books like Men Like Gods, Modern Utopia. He was writing positively optimistic visions of the future instead of pessimistic things like War of the Worlds or The Island of Dr. Moreau. That's part of it. But it's also just this idea, we are too grown up to believe in these optimistic visions of the future. So Orwell imbibed all of this. So before he was a socialist, he was a post-socialist. It's like a paradox, but it's fairly simple. But basically, he had imbibed this fin de siècle ideology that springs from the setbacks that socialism had in the late 19th century. So Orwell you can see this in the remarks about socialism in the Keep the Aspidistra Flying, a novel that Orwell wrote in 1935, published in 1936, you know, where he's clearly anti-socialist. And So this is what's going on. That and of course, Brave New World is itself seen at the time as an anti H.G. Wells book. You know, H.G. Wells has given you Men Like Gods and A Modern Utopia, but it's really going to turn out shockingly like this. So Orwell comes to socialism reluctantly, converts to socialism in 1936, with all this baggage of sort of distrust of any talk of progress and rationality. So this explains a lot of his thinking. Now, if you're going to broaden it to the Fabian Society, I mean, the Fabian Society didn't really have a distinctive view of socialism. The Fabians' view of socialism was not strikingly different from members of the Labour Party or members of the ILP or other organizations. And of course, there was diversity on specific issues. H.G. Wells and George Bernard Shaw were both Fabians, but they came to blows, figuratively speaking, over many issues. I mean, one of the things that I point out is that the conception of socialism, the definition of socialism, was fairly uncontroversial in the 1930s. There was a standard definition of socialism and a standard conception of how socialism could be established. And so when Orwell discusses his conversion to socialism and what it means to be a socialist in the second half of The Road to Wigan Pier, he doesn't waste any time talking about disagreements there might be. He never mentions different conceptions of socialism. And in fact, that's one of the surprise. If you read 1984 and Animal Farm, and that's all you know about Orwell, and then you hear that he was, despite having written those two books, he was a socialist, and say, oh, that's interesting. And you come to read his other writings. One of the things that's a bit surprising and a bit striking is that he has no interest whatsoever at any point in details of how socialism might be made to work a bit differently. You know, he just pays no attention whatsoever to questions like that, or, you know, whether there should be local democracy or workers' control of factories. Never crosses it, you know, never utters a sentence on issues like that. He just takes the definition of what socialism is to be set in stone and uncontroversial.
Yeah, and it seems like another tricky aspect of trying to nail down Orwell, and something that really I sort of knew about it before reading your book, but then I realized it was even more pronounced than I had thought, was how Orwell multiple times on pretty important issues did a very fast 180 on those issues, turnaround on a lot of important things, sometimes literally in the space of a few hours, it seemed like.
Yes, right. This I think is a source of many misunderstandings of Orwell, that he several times made an enormous change, radical change in his outlook, almost instantly, almost you say within a few hours. I mean, it's within a few minutes, actually. Yeah. in some cases, you can pin it down to when he made this change. I mean, the most clearly demonstrable example is what happened in the early hours of August 22nd, 1939, where Orwell had a dream. He woke up from this dream. For the last 2 years and 2 months preceding this, he had been taking an anti-war view of the coming war with Germany, and actually calling for forming an underground organization to sabotage the war when it started. And this is a view that's often called a pacifist view, but that's actually not quite accurate, because many of the people like Orwell who held this view had nothing against physical violence at all. But what they were objecting to was physical violence by one capitalist nation against another capitalist nation. You know, they were taking the old socialist view that the workers have no country, and that wars between nations are simply capitalist disputes and the workers should oppose them. So it's not a pacifist view, but it's usually called pacifism. So he went to bed on the night of August 21st, 1939, a so-called pacifist, that's to say bitterly anti-war. And it's not like a casual throwaway line. I mean, he explained this in great detail over and over again, that one should not support this coming war with Germany, that it would be just like the First World War, where the workers were asked to slaughter each other to defeat Prussian militarism. Now they were being asked to slaughter each other to defeat fascism. And this was just the trick of the ruling classes. And that this coming war had to be stopped and sabotaged at every turn. So he has this dream in the early hours of the morning of August 22nd. And he wakes up and he says, he dreamed that the war had started. He doesn't say anything else about what happened in the dream, but he says that he knew when he woke up that he would support his country in the coming war. So this is literally an overnight conversion. So now he spends the next several years constantly and vituperatively attacking precisely the view that he had been putting for the previous 2 years and 2 months. Now he becomes the arch jingoist and the arch supporter of Britain against Germany, while at the same time saying that we can't possibly win this war unless we have a socialist revolution. So this is his view. And interestingly enough, he had this dream. This is what he says. He had this dream. He woke up convinced that he would be a patriot. He would support Britain against Germany in this war that everybody knew was going to happen. And it happened less than 2 weeks later. Hitler invaded Poland and the war was on, basically. He came downstairs, having made this momentous change in his political ideology, and the newspapers had the headline of Ribbentrop's flight to Moscow, which everybody knew meant that the Third Reich and the Soviet Union had entered into an alliance. And that, of course, one of the consequences of this is that Orwell and the Communist Party switched their positions on almost precisely the same day. The Communist Party switched from being very pro-war to being very anti-war at just the same time that Orwell switched from being very anti-war to very pro-war. this is the ironies of history. That's the most easily demonstrable example of this tendency that Orwell had for sudden conversions.
Yeah, you know,
I
was just going to say, I couldn't help but think when I was reading about that it's a real pity that he never had a compelling dream that convinced him to be in favor of the free market.
Right.
It's too bad.
Yeah. And you didn't hear much about the free market in the 1930s in Britain, believe me. Mm-hmm. In fact, probably if you read Strachey's rather sympathetic treatment of the free market people in The Coming Struggle for Power, which is a piece of communist propaganda, that's probably the most that a typical leftist in Britain would have heard about the free market. I mean, there were a few people like Ernest Benn who were still writing, pro-individualist, pro-free market books, but nobody took them seriously. Now, Orwell, in 1944, reviewed Hayek's The Road to Serfdom, which had just come out, and which in a way marks the revival of classical liberal ideas, and it's a very slight review. It's short, and it's a joint review of Hayek and a book by a communist fellow traveler. So it's not even this small review is not entirely devoted to Hayek, but he does understand what Hayek's getting at, and it's he tacitly Orwell's quite good as a writer at saying one thing, but tacitly sending a slightly different message. And what he says here is that the there are these two books. One says that laissez-faire capitalism is going to lead to terrible things. That would be this book by the fellow traveler Connie Ziliakis. The other one says that the move away from laissez-faire capitalism can lead to terrible things. That would be Hayek's Road to Serfdom. And he says, the tragedy is they may both be right. So there you get Orwell's pessimism. That's the first paragraph. That's Orwell's pessimism about the future and his idea that maybe totalitarianism is going to triumph anyway. Now, so he says very little about Hayek, but what he says, he sends the message tacitly that the Hayek book is much more interesting than the Ziliakis book. And he says this is an interesting book because it's so unfashionable, which is a typical Orwell piece of rhetoric because it gets you curious about it. He wants people to read Hayek, you can tell. But he says, the problem with competitions is that someone wins them, which is a remark that Orwell made several times. And he makes it in this review of Hayek. So in other words, that's a succinct statement of the leftist dogma that competition destroys itself and creates monopoly. So it just can't last. But then he mentions his theory that people want security, and so they will vote in more and more government regulation. He mentions that as well. Orwell died at the age of 46, and if he'd lived a more normal lifespan, who knows what he might have come round to.
Yeah, and then there's his rather abrupt shift on the topic of anarchism, where prior to becoming a socialist, he, I think, sometimes referred to himself as a Tory anarchist.
Right.
Which, if memory serves, I think Tolkien referred to himself in those terms or was referred to by someone else in those terms.
Yeah.
But then he pretty abruptly not only abandoned the Tory anarchist label, but really kind of abandoned any sympathy whatsoever for any sort of anarchism. How and why did he have a shift like that against anarchism?
Right. I mean, the thing is this. It wasn't that he wasn't sympathetic to anarchism. It's that he thought it was just hopeless. You know, it was part of this... something happened to him, to his thinking, in the years, say, 1934 to 1936, that convinced him that collectivism was inevitable, and that to talk about small property holdings having a role in the future, for example, was just hopelessly naive and childish. You know, I think that Orwell tended to find himself in agreement with anarchists. He had friends who were anarchists. And of course, when he was in Spain for nearly 6 months, Spain was distinguished among all countries in the world by having millions of anarchists in its population. So he was aware of anarchists. But, you know, if you read his book about Spain, his experiences in Spain, Homage to Catalonia, one of the striking things about that is that he never discusses anarchism. He spends a few sentences pointing out the difference between the way communists see the world and the way anarchists see the world. But basically, it comes back to this idea that he has no interest in the minor details of socialism because he thinks that this coming collectivist society is set in stone. It's not something that we can debate about. So, you know, he just thinks that anarchism is out of the question, and that you've got to face it. Orwell had this conceit that he called his power of facing unpleasant facts, and he liked to he liked to think of himself as someone who could face unpleasant facts. One of the aspects of this is that when he adopted a point of view, he would keep on mentioning some problem with that point of view. It's one of the attractive things about Orwell, in a way. Mm-hmm. You know, so he would have a point of view, but then he would always mention the problem with it. He put this down to his power of facing unpleasant facts. I mean, I think most of the unpleasant facts he prided himself upon facing were actually falsehoods, but this is part of his view of the world. And incidentally, it is reported that Orwell called himself a Tory anarchist. That's pretty well documented. But in none of his extant writings does he call himself a Tory anarchist. However, he does call someone else a Tory anarchist. And that happens to be the author who had the biggest impact on Orwell of any other writer. And that is Jonathan Swift.
Right.
He calls Jonathan Swift a Tory anarchist. Orwell actually wrote an imaginary interview that he's conducting with Jonathan Swift. And of course, Jonathan Swift in Gulliver's Travels is a big enemy of progress and science and mathematics even. Basically, this interview that Orwell conducts, imaginary interview that Orwell conducts with Jonathan Swift, is an interview of Orwell interviewing the earlier Orwell. So it's actually Orwell. I forget the exact date when he wrote this interview, but it's, you know, it's during the war, it's Orwell in the 1940s interviewing Orwell in the 1930s. And of course, what happened to Orwell was that after he became a socialist in 1936 with very anti-progress and anti-machine views, he gradually moderated those anti-progress and anti-machine views. So in a way, on that respect, he became a more typical leftist, because most leftists were very positive about economic growth. What we would call economic growth, that wasn't part of the language of political discourse then. But in Marxist terms, the advancement of the forces of production. So, you know, Orwell thought of identified this Tory anarchism with his earlier anti-progress views. And so you can see there, it's all keyed in with this idea that if you face the realities of the modern world, then it means you face the reality of a lot of central direction. And therefore, anarchism is out of the question.
Mm-hmm. On a bit different topic, I found your discussions in the book of Orwell's views on kind of manliness and masculinity to be very interesting. And it made me right away think of Ernest Hemingway, who, you know, basically a contemporary of Orwell's. And the parallels were kind of interesting.
Right.
Another prominent left winger, another renowned writer, of course, also involved somewhat in the Spanish Civil War. And both of them strong supporters of this kind of old fashioned macho masculinity sort of ideal. Can you talk a little bit about Orwell's views on masculinity? And,
yeah,
you know, these they just seem so the opposite of like the present day left. The present day left often talking about toxic masculinity and all that. That's all I could think of when I was reading about Orwell.
Right, right. There's a lot of implications here. I'll just touch upon a few points. I mean, first of all, you have to understand, and you do understand, but just for the benefit of some listeners who may not, that the present day kind of pro, should we say, gender flexibility view existed in the 1930s, but it was a very small portion of the left. And the left was generally strongly adhered to machismo. This comes right up to Fidel Castro's concentration camps for homosexuals, you know.
Very, very socially conservative, a lot of the old school left.
Right. And also there is this idea that that capitalism is responsible for this horrible disease of homosexuality, and in fact all sexual perversions. You know that it's due to the alienating effects of capitalism and life in big cities and delayed marriage because of the modern way of life. that we have things like homosexuality. You know, basically, in the medieval village, there was no homosexuality, right?
Yeah.
It didn't exist because people married when they were 12 years old or whatever, and, you know, they had no problems, so they didn't spend their time morbidly developing these perversities. So there is this idea. Now, part of the thing here is that there was a very broad thing that goes beyond the political left of seeing part of this van der Ziekle reaction against progress took the form of saying, well, you have progress in some areas, but it leads to regress or degeneration in other areas. So this was a popular idea at the beginning of the 20th century among intellectuals, that when you have progress, you have degeneration accompanying it. So this is something that Orwell accepted. He thought that one of the things about, and what one of the aspects of this was that in the 1930s, there was this extreme concern about the falling birth rate, which was almost like global warming is today. It reached a peak in 1936, and then after that it started to disappear a bit because of the pressing problem of the coming war. But the white races, however you want to look at it, the white race or the national race, the British race, were not having enough babies. So there's this perception of that the population is not replacing itself, and that this is part of the degeneration caused by, well, some people would say capitalism, some people would just say not so politically motivated would just say civilization. You know, advanced civilization is inherently destructive. It may look quite good. It provides certain novelties and goodies for the masses, but it's one at the expense of this tendency to collapse. And part of the tendency to collapse is that people stop having babies. So this is definitely something Orwell completely believed in, the idea that you have to do something to reverse this collapse of fertility. And one of the things he mentions occasionally, that a socialist revolution, there'll be an immediate increase in the birth rate. And by the way, that fits in with another of his views, which is that this is the facing unpleasant facts category, is that immediately after a socialist revolution, living standards will probably fall. And one of the reasons, there's two reasons he says this, basically. One is that a socialist revolution means liberation for the colonies, so you give up the empire. And it Orwell believed that the workers' incomes in Britain were high because of the empire. That's completely wrong, but that's what he believed. The other reason is that people start having more babies again, and that will depress their incomes because they'll be using what incomes they have to feed their children. So all these ideas go together. The idea of that capitalism is in this miserable, alienated, anti-fertile kind of mode. It creates these big cities where people are lonely and don't get in touch with each other, don't have babies or don't have enough of them. And that leads to the collapse of civilization, if nothing else will. And so, you know, all these ideas are swirling around in Orwell's mind. And he actually says, you know, that he gives a list of five qualities that any viable society must have. And one of them is what he calls philoprogenitiveness, which means a high valuation for having babies. That it's absolutely essential for any society that it must replace itself by having babies. And this is a great danger. This was a big scare. It was like global warming today in the 1930s. The big scare was the collapse of fertility and the birth dearth, as it was called. So Orwell bought into all this, and And of course, some of it is correct. There was a collapse of fertility, and you know, part of the reason why Sweden is becoming a Muslim caliphate is because of the the collapse of fertility of the old European populations.
Yeah, well, tying back to the topic of the British Empire, it again seems like an instance where his views were, at least among the left of that time period, highly conventional, because it seems like he basically just uncritically accepted the kind of Hobson-Lenin analysis of imperialism, that it's simply about the mother country overall, meaning even the working classes of the mother country enriching themselves, which is kind of a pretty empirically problematic view of what the empire really did economically.
I mean, right.
My view is much more of like a public choice view. And I think that's similar to your view as well, where the empire seems like did provide concentrated benefits to certain special interest groups. In the mother country.
Absolutely.
But
yes.
But not a net benefit to the overall economy as a whole of the mother country,
right.
Nor
right.
a net benefit to kind of the average, you know, working class or perhaps even middle class person.
Right, right. I think that's right. And there were people at the time who pointed out that there were real problems with the idea that people in Britain were better off because of the empire. There was a book by Norman Angell, The Great Illusion, which is basically, I think the first edition was something like 1909, and it was a huge seller through the ensuing years, new editions coming out every few years. Its basic argument was that it could not be financially advantageous for a modern nation to get involved in a war. You know, it was always going to be an economic loss maker to get involved in a war. And I think his argument is quite correct, I think, on that point. But one of the points that Angell makes is that Britain doesn't derive any economic benefit from pushing around other countries. It's just a myth. And he actually makes the quite astute point that there was a tendency for the parts of the empire to become more and more self-governing. And of course, some of them became dominions. That's to say, they were completely, in practice, they were completely independent nations. Canada and Australia were populated by people who thought of themselves as British and that sort of thing. But they're actually Britain had no control over their policies whatsoever. I mean, and Angell pointed out that that Britain had less power to determine the policies of the dominions than it had to determine the policies of completely foreign countries, because it could push them around without fearing any that they would leave the empire or the Commonwealth, as it was called. When they were dealing with Canada, they had to be careful because, of course, they always had the specter of the American Revolution. You know, if you don't treat the colonists too well, then they may leave. They may have a revolution against you. So there's always that. But there were people who put forward quite convincingly a case against this idea. And one of them was Bertrand Russell. Bertrand Russell, in one respect, was just like Orwell. That's to say, he was a so-called pacifist who opposed the coming war. And then he switched to accepting that you had to support the war against Hitler. But at the end of the period, or not right at the end, but when he was putting his anti-war position, why you shouldn't go to war against Hitler, he wrote a book called Which Way to Peace. And one of the things he has in there is an analysis, quite short, but it's quite convincing, of how it cannot be the case that that Britain benefits economically from its empire, benefits in the sense that the living standard of people in Britain would be higher because of the empire. So there were people who pointed out the contrary, but as you say, Lenin's theory of imperialism was widely accepted on the left, and that argued that the imperial powers extracted super profits from that's Lenin's term, super profits from the empire, and used these super profits to bribe a section of the working class with higher wages so that they would become nationalistic and imperialistic. So that was Lenin's theory, and without attributing it to Lenin, this is something that Orwell accepted. And in fact, it was like an obsession with him. Orwell frequently, many times throughout his writings, over the years, refers to the empire, and almost always, maybe always, certainly almost always, he puts forward this idea that workers' living standards in Britain are higher because of the empire. And if we give up the empire, he says we've got to give up the empire. But if we give up the empire, workers' living standards will fall because, you know, they won't be subsidized by the empire. So this is something he just reiterated again and again and again. By the way, one of the things about Orwell and homosexuality is that people, one of the misunderstandings about Orwell is that this is the way that people tend to look at it. They read Orwell and they find that he has these remarks against homosexuals. And they think, oh, well, you know, he was a child of his time. And Christopher Hitchens says Orwell had an involuntary shudder about homosexuality, which is what you expect a heterosexual male to have. And he fought to contain this and to subdue it. You have to hear the idea that being opposed to homosexuality is a kind of fault. It's an emotional fault due to an involuntary shudder. Now, actually, Orwell was completely blasé about homosexuality. He didn't have any kind of involuntary shudder about it. He was friendly with people he knew to be homosexuals. This was a kind of grand social engineering kind of view that he had. That homosexuality was a very bad symptom of capitalism. That was his view. If you look at that Orwell's relations with Stephen Spender, for example, Stephen Spender was very important at the time because T.S. Eliot somewhat carelessly gave the impression in a review of Spender's first volume of poems that he was the future great poet. Of course, Stephen Spender's quite a mediocre poet, actually. But anyway, so a lot of people had great hopes for Stephen Spender. And Stephen Spender was a lifelong gay and very much involved in all kinds of gay relationships. Orwell, when he first had some dealings with Spender, he referred to him contemptuously as that pansy, that Nancy poet, and, you know, all these slightly derogatory anti-gay terms. But then he met Spender and they had a conversation, and Spender had this brief fling with the Communist Party and then had arrived at a view of the Communist Party very much like Orwell's after 1937. That's to say, completely and utterly hostile to it as being this treacherous, you know, anti-working class, anti-liberty kind of organization that was completely under the control of Moscow and was completely amoral in its workings. And once Orwell realized that Spender had exactly the same view of communism and the Soviet Union as he did, they hit it off splendidly, and they often socialized and were happy in each other's company. And the fact that Spender was a homosexual didn't bother Orwell one bit, you know. Orwell had these things. He would attack Scottishness, he would attack Catholics, and so on. These groups of people in those days, it wasn't considered terrible to make derogatory remarks about an entire group of people.
Right.
That wasn't considered automatically an evil thing. So, he would run down Roman Catholics in an extremely strong way. He's a stinking RC, he says in one point about in a private letter to someone about someone else, a stinking RC. And that, there was this idea in the 1930s in England that it was okay to run down whole groups of people. And of course, Orwell ran down the English quite a lot. But when you met an individual, you took that individual on their merits, and you didn't allow your view of the whole group to color the way you treated that individual. So that was it's a very quaint, old-fashioned view that nobody holds anymore, but this is the view that Orwell held.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So bigotry is okay on a macro level, but you need to turn it off on a micro level.
I don't think it was particularly bigotry. I think it's just, you know, the view that certain broad groups of human beings do have certain characteristics, and some of these you may not like, and it's okay to say that. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can say that it was even bigotry. It's just a natural human response, I think, mm-hmm. unless you have some peculiar sort of code of ethics that says that you must never do that.
Well, obviously, Orwell is nowhere near the independent mind that he's often thought to be, and obviously a lot of his views are, in one way or another, problematic. But overall, what would you say about Orwell as an author and a literary figure? Is he still worth reading, and do you think that he and his books deserve to be as well known as they are?
Oh yes, I mean, I think obviously what everybody knows about Animal Farm in 1984. I mean, I think a point I would make about those two books is they were instant huge bestsellers, and I would say this, that if anybody ever writes an instant huge bestseller, it must be because they're telling a lot of people what they already want to hear. And I think that's true of those two books, Animal Farm and 1984. When they came out, and in the succeeding years and decades, told a lot of people what they wanted to hear. So they were not breaking new ground in the message they conveyed. And I think this is true of all best-selling works of fiction that have a political component. I mean, if you think about I suppose that one of the best examples would be Uncle Tom's Cabin, which was a huge blockbuster bestseller when it came out. It caused the American Civil War, right? As yeah. Abe Lincoln once said, when Abe Lincoln was introduced to Harriet Beecher Stowe, he said, "You're the little woman who wrote the book that made this great war." That was in 1863, 10 years after Uncle Tom's right. Cabin came out. And so it was a very consequential book. It had a big impact on people's views, but the impact it had was not that of creating a new point of view that hadn't existed before and converting millions of people to that, but of somewhat accentuating a view that already existed, in this case, radical abolitionism, and gaining more adherence and more enthusiastic adherence for that point of view. And if you say, what is the message of Uncle Tom's Cabin? Well, the message is something like, this is slavery, just look at it. The message of 1984 is, this is collectivism taken to the extreme. Look at it. We're not going to get great insights in political philosophy from 1984. It's a powerful work, and it very powerfully restates things that had already been said by other people. It was very close to what millions of people already wanted to hear. The same for Animal Farm. Many people read those two books, and then they read some other stuff by Orwell. And actually, There's only two books by Orwell that are really bad, and they are A Clergyman's Daughter is the worst. There's no reason for anybody to read that unless they're interested in Orwell as a specialty, as I am. And then Keep the Aspidistra Flying is not as bad as A Clergyman's Daughter, but it's not an outstanding novel. But all his other books, and that includes Coming Up for Air, wonderful novel. Burmese Days, a novel about his life in Burma. His his book on the Spanish Civil War, and so on. All, they're all worth reading. But then I think if you read a lot of Orwell, it's the short pieces, the hundreds of short pieces, which eventually give you the most pleasure. You know, the many, many short articles, short book reviews, short columns that he wrote about all kinds of issues over the years. So I think he's a great writer, but he's not a great writer because he had correct views that nobody else had. Right. That's the big mistake. People think, oh, Orwell is a great writer, it must be because he had the right opinions when nobody else did. Well, that's wrong in two ways. First of all, his opinions were generally wrong and not right. And secondly, his opinions were generally in harmony with what thousands of other leftist intellectuals and writers were saying at the time.
Well, David, it's been a very interesting conversation. And I just want to say a big thank you to you for taking the time to chat with me today.
Oh, well, thanks for the opportunity to sound off with my correct views on everything.
My pleasure. Thank you for listening to the Dangerous History Podcast. Check out the website, profcj.org, or you can just put in dangeroushistorypodcast.com to get the show notes for this and every other Dangerous History Podcast episode. While you're there, you can email subscribe to the site over in the right-hand side, and if you put in your email address there and subscribe, you won't get any spam or anything like that from me, no junk email. You'll simply get an email notification every time something new is posted at my website. You can follow me and the show on Facebook and Twitter as well, and you can subscribe to the podcast in iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, however you prefer to consume your podcasts. If you enjoy and appreciate this show, there are many different ways you can help me keep this show going, growing, and constantly improving. One easy way is simply to spread the word about the Dangerous History Podcast to those you think might appreciate it who don't already know about it. And you can also help the show out by leaving ratings or reviews in venues such as iTunes, which helps the podcast get ranked more highly. If you would like to help out the show financially, there are many ways to do so, and you'll find them at profcj.org/donate. And one of the best, most helpful is to sign up to support the show via Patreon at patreon.com/profcj. And if you pledge a contribution of at least $5 per month or more, you'll have access to bonus episodes that I publish in Patreon available nowhere else, as well as the ability to join the Dangerous History Podcast Scholar Warriors private Facebook group. You can also make one-time or recurring donations via PayPal, and you can donate via Bitcoin as well. And of course, if you buy things from any of my Amazon affiliate links or my Abe Books affiliate links, go through those links, then do your shopping as normal, and the Dangerous History Podcast will get a small commission at no additional cost to you. This has been another episode of the Dangerous History Podcast, helping you learn the past so you can understand the present and prepare for the future.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.